Our next speaker is Edward Olson. Professor Olson is Professor of National Security Affairs, specializing in Asian Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's taught at George Williams College and served as Political Intelligence Analyst with the Office of East Asian and Pacific Affairs with the U.S. State Department. He's the author of 20 books and monographs, including the one I just showed you earlier called U.S. National Defense for the 21st Century and Toward Normalizing U.S.-Korean Relations in Due Course. I'm delighted to introduce Ed Olson.
Thank you very much. Excuse my voice, it's giving out a little bit today. I think it's an allergy or something. I'm not going to read from the books. I'm just putting these down so I have a little higher podium, because the podium, if you can't see it, I have bifocals, and if I put my notes down there, I don't think I could read them at that level. Since I do teach at the Naval Postgraduate School for the federal government, I were required to give a disclaimer that whatever I say is my personal view. It'll become fairly obvious fairly quickly, but but we're required to say that. As the U.S. copes, let me put my watch up here so I don't run over time. As the U.S. has been coping with the challenges of adjusting to the post 9/11 security environment, a lot of issues have loomed large. On the national security side, the wisdom of pursuing a preemptive strategy is especially important. All consumers are supposed to be guided by the warning embodied in the ancient Latin expression, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. I modified that a bit in a recent article, and I'm going to take off on that a bit, named the caveat preemptor, let the preemptor beware. U.S. national strategy has always embodied a blend of defensive and offensive capabilities. This is basically universally accepted in the saying, the best defense is a good offense. It's always there. In this context, the post 9/11 decision of the Bush administration to focus on both U.S. defensive and offensive preparedness is in keeping with this tradition. Neither does the administration's willingness to entertain some preemptive measures, I emphasize some, deviate from that tradition. An emphasis on preemption basically is akin to the periodic reminders by officials in Washington that the U.S. has the option of using nuclear weapons. It doesn't mean they're going to use it, but basically it's laid out there as a possibility. Basically, this is a way for the U.S. To remind the world that nuclear weapons are part of the U.S.'s arsenal, thereby underscoring deterrence policy. But in that sense, it's not new. The risk inherent in this is that, like nuclear escalation in the Cold War, preemptive option could get out of hand if terrorists or rogue states ever call the U.S.'s bluff in a major way. In short, there's nothing new about occasional U.S. use of military preemption, especially in the middle of active warfare. Even during periods of non-overt warfare, during the Cold War, the U.S. is engaged in covert armed intervention in other states. Whether it's fair or not is debatable, but there's a legacy of this. But today's usage of the preemption idea that's affirmed in President Bush's West Point speech in June of 2002 and the subsequent report on U.S. national security does differ because it more openly stresses the U.S.'s prerogative to undertake preemptive military actions against perceived threats and then simultaneously to back away from established reliance on deterrence traditions. This is a significant shift in U.S. policy that's raised questions about the broad-based merits of strategic preemption versus strategic deterrence. By making military preemption overtly prominent within a formal strategic doctrine, the U.S. in effect is reducing the covert nature of what can be affected beneath the surface geopolitical activity, and that's where the questions arise. In the process of doing this, the level of focus has shifted. This puts the spotlight on an approach to geopolitics that many have criticized for having hegemonic overtones. By behaving like a heavy-handed hegemon prepared to preempt potential threats to the U.S. status as the world's sole superpower, American leaders open themselves to much harsher criticism that the U.S. is what's often referred to as a hyperpower, bent on some form of imperium. Although most advocates of U.S. Preemption doctrine avoid any explicit advocacy of U.S. embassy, there are some who, as was suggested previously, are blunt in positing the merits of an explicit empire. Whether the U.S. will ever really seek such a role, I think so far, is really hypothetical, despite the accusations that the Bush administration is really doing it. But the Bush doctrine does make it more plausible, and it's indicated palpable risks in doing so. If this set of priorities is considered logical and acceptable for Americans in defense of the U.S., and if it's deemed viable, what is it to prevent other countries from perceiving it as a strategic role model? The two sets of countries that should be a concern to Americans in this regard, one is our allies and the other is our adversaries. It's basically the whole world, almost the whole world. We're allies of the U.S. to emulate the preemptive principle behind the U.S. strategy as an expression of their support, was to prevent one or more of them from launching a unilateral preemptive military strike against a perceived threat. Would such an attack, if it's considered legitimate by an ally using the U.S.'s logic, obligate the U.S. to stand by the ally? If the answer is yes, then Americans had better reappraise the nature of the U.S. ally and how their geopolitical context could entangle Americans in wars that are not of their choosing. If the answer is no, then why should those allies be expected to stand by the U.S. in the context of any preemptive American attack against a perceived enemy? There are a number of examples of that, but I'll draw those from my own area of expertise in Asia. A few of them stand out in small ways. One of them, two of them, so-called regional deputies, Japan and Australia. The Koizumi government in Tokyo has dabbled a little bit with the notion of preemption vis-a-vis North Korea's nuclear weapons and missiles. The Howard government in Canberra has raised the option more explicitly vis-a-vis Southeast Asian terrorist dangers. But another one, sort of extended Asia, Southwest Asia, and I won't dwell on this because it's already been addressed, is Israel, which basically has had its own version of a preemption doctrine for decades, and may in fact have served as a de facto role model for the U.S.'s version of preemption. In either case, whether it's yes and no in terms of other countries doing it, is it in the U.S.'s national interest and of disparate friends and allies to clarify in advance each side's obligations? I would say yes. I think these clarifications can be spelled out in all the security treaties and executive agreements that constitute the framework of U.S. strategic ties worldwide. Fortunately, the U.S.'s relationships with these countries are supposed to be based on mutuality, and that should be relatively easy to inject those clarifications in the security ties if we really wanted to. It could also be based on the U.S. securing the sole prerogative to take preemptive military actions with no obligation to friends and allies to support such actions. And lastly, either ally, the U.S. or the others, could pursue military preemptive options on its own initiative, on the understanding that there would be no obligations for the security partner to support those actions. The situation with existing or potential adversaries is far, far more daunting. As the U.S. military preemption doctrine becomes acknowledged as a viable option for U.S. Policy, what's to stop the leaders of our adversaries from copying the U.S. in a hostile manner? If such countries, especially the remaining two in the so-called axis of evil, Iran and North Korea, and I'll dwell on North Korea, are confident that the U.S. is fully prepared and willing to launch a preemptive war on one or more of them, why should they avoid contemplating what could be labeled a policy of preemptive preemption, designed to preempt the U.S. preemptor before it can preempt? I know that's complex, but the U.S.'s regime change in war in Iraq, I think, offers myriad lessons to the U.S.'s allies and adversaries that there are somewhere else on the spectrum that don't fall in between. For present purposes, the lesson that any country or non-state player that fears a U.S. preemptive move against it is certain to learn is that Saddam Hussein either waited too long or was inadequately prepared to cope with American preemption. Learning this lesson heightens the risk of preemptive preemption. Although others may be tempted, I think North Korea's situation is especially daunting. North Korea's reaction to the announcement of the preemption aspect of the Bush Doctrine was far more ominous than Iraq or Iran. In several respects, North Korea is a much more formidable adversary than Iraq was. With an enormous military with provable WMD, it's noted for its fanaticism, and nobody visualizes it achieving preemptive regime change in Pyongyang as a low-risk task. Although its economy is a mess, its military does not share the liabilities evident in Iraq's military. Moreover, North Korea has a track record of provocative brinkmanship strategy that's willing to push the U.S. to the cusp of war. Against this background, when the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, adopted a harder line toward North Korea, the North Koreans have launched a new round of nuclear brinkmanship, but also in the process, they've adapted the preemption doctrine for themselves. A North Korean spokesman, actually the deputy defense foreign ministry official, said that the U.S. Says that after Iraq we are next, but we have our own countermeasures. This is a quote: "Preemptive attacks are not the exclusive right of the U.S." In other words, we can do it too, North Koreans. Whether they really can is debatable, but they say they can. That's kind of true. I think the plausibility is basically questionable. It doesn't take much imagination to visualize the risks this convoluted psychology could unleash. Instead of preventing war scenarios as mutual deterrence is intended to, mutual preemptive strategies could readily exacerbate the prospects for armed conflicts. The U.S. may be able to utilize effectively a preemptive strike against the first of the enemies, such as Iraq, but all the others waiting in the wings, all now face major incentives to try to preempt the U.S. preemptor. North Korea seems to be at the head of the line in states willing to follow through on those initiatives and incentives. Whether they do, we'll see. I think it's important to note that for all its sinister qualities, North Korea remains a territorial state with all the attendant geopolitical vulnerabilities. Moreover, both Korea's North and South share ambitions to reunify their nation into a single state via constructive diplomacy. So there are plenty of options, even though North Korea does seem to be at the head of the line of countries that are basically willing to test the U.S. on preemption. But there are a lot more and greater dangers from radical non-state actors that don't have much to lose. When dealing with such terrorists or their supporters, there's basically little effective deterrence for the U.S. to use. I'll differ somewhat with my colleagues here that in terms of, other than using threats of preemptive strikes designed to destroy their organizational infrastructure and transnational support network. The trouble is that unlike the grander deterrence with which Americans became familiar with during the Cold War, there's little today to inhibit today's terrorist adversaries from turning the tables on the U.S. These terrorists have little to lose and perceive their brand of preemption as far more effective than anything the U.S. can inflict on them. For these terrorists, preemptive armed attacks in the U.S. or American interests abroad can be psychologically effective in terms of exerting pressure on American society aimed at getting the U.S. government to alter its policies in ways that meet the goals of these terrorists. Fortunately, that's not true regarding U.S. relations with most of the world, where traditional forms of deterrence remain the norm. In most areas of the world, U.S. strategic preemption, I think, will primarily remain a hypothetical proposition aimed at aspiring rogue states to let them know where the boundaries of international security are. Most likely, the use of strengthened strategic preemption will focus on U.S. policies toward terrorist entities. Nonetheless, before the U.S. goes too far down the path towards strategic preemption, Americans had better contemplate what it may be like if the U.S. finds itself either caught up in or on the receiving end of other countries or terrorist groups' emulation of the U.S. emphasis on military preemption. Fortunately, the likelihood of any ally emulating the U.S. policy issue is still slim. But that's not true with regard to some real or potential adversaries. They have pretty strong reason to consider preemptive preemption. I'm not suggesting that this means that the U.S. should necessarily forego preemption as a last resort option, but it does mean that the U.S. should not stray too far from its established strategic principles of deterrence. The primary form of U.S. preemption should remain diplomatic and economic, leaving military preemption as a low-profile contingency option for use only when all else fails. Excessive emphasis, real or rhetorical, on military preemption would not necessarily enhance U.S. national security and could expose the U.S. to being entangled in an open-ended state of war. Furthermore, this level of emphasis on preemption as a key part of U.S. strategic policy unwisely suggests a hegemonic empire bent on overturning challenges to far-flung outposts. It's far sounder for the U.S. to focus on strategic policy that's appropriate for a republic, defending against threats to its national territorial security. And in this context, caveat preemptor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. Our final speaker is Ivan Elin, who is Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty here at the Independent Institute and also Assistant Editor of the Independent Review. I might mention just briefly something about the center that Ivan is directing. We organized the center this past winter, and you'll find information on our website. Go to the homepage and scroll down. It's about the fourth or fifth item. You can click there and find out further information about the center. The purpose of the center is to pursue a peer-reviewed academic program involving various scholars and policy analysts to produce new books and other publications, to hold events like this, as well as larger events and do various media projects. The website I mentioned, called onpower.org, is also a project of the center, and we believe that you'll be hearing more and more about the center in the future, and of course you're welcome to ask Ivan questions about that more specifically later. Ivan received his PhD in history from George Washington University. He's been a director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute. He was principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office. He was evaluator in charge for national security and intelligence for the U.S. General Accounting Office and investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's the author of the book I mentioned earlier called Putting Defense Back in the U.S. Defense Policy, and many other studies in various books as well as in many leading journals. Delighted to introduce Ivan Eland.
Thanks, everybody, for coming to our first forum in that the center is putting on here. It's a great pleasure to speak to everyone tonight. I'm going to speak more generally. I'm not going to go into as much regional detail because we have two regional experts here on the Middle East and East Asia. I'm going to discuss U.S. foreign policy in general. Bush has come out with this preemptive strike policy, but I think it's really been missold. It's not preemptive at all. It's more preventative. A preemptive attack is when you preempt the other side when you know that the side is about ready to attack you. Certainly no one can argue with that, as Ed was alluding to. It has to be a part of any national security policy because who would let themselves be attacked? However, a preventative doctrine is much different. What you do is you try to hit the other side before they become a threat. And of course, that's what we were trying to do in Iraq. That's what we would be trying to do if we attacked Syria or North Korea. Now, this is very dangerous, I think, because any nation can be portrayed as an imminent threat, or a threat in, not an imminent threat, but a threat that could be serious down the way, down the road. So I think there's nothing really new here except the fact, because Clinton also used preventative threats as well. He threatened North Korea with war in 1994 if they didn't freeze their nuclear program. We've had other presidents who used the preventative threat. Now, I also don't think there's too much of a new in the Imperial Department. The United States, in my view, has had a worldwide empire since the end of World War II during the Cold War. The Soviet Union also had an empire which is much smaller, but the two empires did battle, and not in a hot sense, but in a cold sense, and occasionally around the periphery. And of course, the U.S. has intervened all over the world since then. Now, we don't like to call this an imperial policy in the United States because that kind of goes against our tradition of, we were the victims of imperialism at the birth of our nation. But nevertheless, and the Cold War disguised this imperial policy, but if we look at what's happened since the Cold War, we still have all the Cold War alliances left. We have military bases all over the world which were put there during the Cold War. And so this should lead us to the conclusion that maybe these bases were not totally to fight the Soviet Union. And so we are actually expanding our defense perimeter and contracting it, as we probably should have after the Cold War. We're expanding NATO, letting more countries in NATO, and we're expanding the mission of NATO. NATO used to be a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union. Now we're conducting offensive operations in Bosnia and Kosovo and other places. We're strengthening our East Asian alliances. We now have quasi-permanent bases, or I should say semi-permanent bases in Central Asia. We're occupying Afghanistan and Iraq to a lesser extent. We're getting militarily involved in Yemen, Georgia, and the Philippines, based on ostensibly because of the war on terror, But if you look at those situations, at least in the Georgia and the Philippines case, it's very questionable whether this really relates to the war on terror. So I think we've had this a preventative doctrine, and we've also had an imperial policy, although our empire is not based on the Roman model of where we march in with the legions and take over the territory. It's based more on the Greek model, where we have commercial, cultural influence, that, but it's backed up with military power. But nonetheless, it is an imperial policy and has been in the post-war era. I think Bush has taken it farther than Clinton and the rest of the presidents before him did, because he is now conducting ground invasions and changing regimes. Clinton chose to bomb from 15,000 feet in Kosovo. Clinton was very reluctant to get involved on the ground after Somalia. Also, the Bush rhetoric is a bit less sophisticated than the Clinton rhetoric and some of the presidents that's gone before him. Clinton dressed all this up in humanitarian clothes, and at one level, Americans like that because we like to help people and everything, but on the other level, we see that the policy is conducted for other reasons. Bush is more in your face, and I think this is why there's such a debate going on over the policy. Now, I'll get to some of the practical aspects. Is this going to work, this more aggressive policy? I don't think that we have good enough intelligence for preventative attacks, and I think recent history has borne that out. In addition, I think that this counter-proliferation doctrine, where we threaten or actually attack countries to get them to get rid of their nuclear weapons or biological weapons, is counterproductive. First of all, if I'm Syria, Libya, or Iran, and I'm out there watching, I see what happens to Iraq that doesn't have nuclear weapons. They get overrun and invaded. I see what happens to North Korea, which is treated much more gingerly. What am I going to do? I'm going to race out and get nuclear weapons as fast as I can. And that's what the Iranians are doing. And the Bush administration seems amazed that this is happening. But you know, there are reasons for it. Also, I think this was alluded to earlier, but I think this policy is unsustainable in America. Eventually, the American people are going to say, well, you know, we can't keep doing all these wars, and what threats do these countries pose? And I think any military action that will be taken in the future after this latest dust up over all the intelligence, at least in Washington, will be examined a bit more carefully. Whether the American people will examine it, I think they eventually will if this policy keeps happening. And I think that it's very hard to sustain this sort of a policy in a democracy, in a republic. Now, I'm going to address this to both liberals and conservatives. I'm going to start with the conservatives. I'm going to tell everybody why a conservative should be against an empire. First of all, war has been the biggest cause of big government in the 20th century. And if you don't like big government, then you got to get rid of war. And to prove my point, and I think Bob Higgs is actually one of the true pioneers, the guy who wrote this book, Crisis and Leviathan, but he shows in the book that World War I, we always think of big government starting in the New Deal, but actually big government really started, that is, total social mobilization started in World War I. Actually, big government probably started as far back as the Civil War. But during World War I, the nation, the whole economy was mobilized for war. Well, after that, it set the precedent for government intervention in the economy and social policy and everything else. So what we saw in the New Deal was they brought back a lot of these agencies, renamed them. They even had some of the same people heading them, and they certainly relied on the precedent of World War I. Before World War I, the federal government made up 2% of the U.S. economy, the GDP. Now we're at about 17 or 18% after two world wars, a depression, a Cold War, etc. So if you don't think war causes big government and empire causes big government, you have to just look at the track record. Of course, all the spending leads to higher taxes, and conservatives don't like taxes. They also don't like the inflation that war causes, and they also don't like the slower economic growth when resources are diverted from the more productive private sector into the government. We also see trade protectionism as people get more nationalistic. And this is one thing that really should bother conservatives. The imperial overstretch could cause us to eventually fall as a world power. If you would have asked the British at the height of their empire in 1914, if 30 years later the empire would be in shambles, you would have gotten raucous laughter. If you'd ask a high Soviet official in the early 80s if by 1991 the Soviet empire would have collapsed because of excessive military spending and the insufficient economic power to support that, you would have gotten raucous laughter. But of course, those empires are in the dustbin of history, as are many previously. Now, I think we do have a problem. We have 40% of the world's military spending, but only 30% of the world's GDP. That's a 10% difference, and over the long term, that's going to cause a big problem. Because what will happen is, and other nations already freeload off our defense spending. We spend $400 billion a year on defense. That's what the next 12 countries spend combined. All these other countries, if they do it right, they can channel that money that they don't spend on defense into the private sector, and their growth rates will outstrip the U.S., and lo and behold, the root of all power is ultimately economic power. You can't build a big military if you don't have a big economy. And so these countries could overtake us, and China is doing exactly that now. Europeans could do it if they got rid of some of their excess social spending and put it back into the private sector. So this is not out of the realm of possibility. Another reason why conservatives should be opposed to empire is that empire really doesn't have anything to do with national security, and in fact, it probably undermines it. The founders of this country realized that we have unique geographical advantages. We have two huge oceans, we have weak and friendly neighbors, and we now have something that the founders didn't have, and it's a big plus, 6,000 nuclear weapons. And I'll tell you, that's a big deterrent to anybody who wants to attack us or invade us. So against conventional threats, and I note the conventional, I said, we're very secure, and that's one reason that the founders wanted to stay out of wars, and also because they, as Madison, I think, put it best, war is the biggest threat to liberty that we face. I'll get into that a little bit later. We've seen, and you get the Clintonites and others that come in and they say, well, but the world is a more interdependent place. We have to watch any little threat anywhere in the world because, my God, the world is interdependent. Well, in some senses it is. Communication and transportation advances have made the world a smaller place. But if you look at cross-border aggression, which is the real any real threat to U.S. security would come there, that's been declining for decades. And of course, the nuclear weapons is probably a part of that. It's not the total factor. But the one thing that might be in the security area that might be more globalized is blowback. If we get involved in remote places, we're going to have more of a chance of blowback here in the United States. And what do I mean by that? 9/11 was an example of blowback where we were attacked because of our foreign policy. So empire is a foreign policy, but it's not a national security policy. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Another reason that conservatives should be a little bit reluctant to endorse empire is the fact that the costs and benefits of profligate military intervention overseas have changed, yet our policy has been on autopilot. The benefits of an intervention were probably greater during the Cold War when we had a Soviet superpower to contend with. We no longer have that. In contrast, the costs of intervention have gone up dramatically. There were costs during the Cold War. We had a situation where we could have had a nuclear war, but most of the superpowers really managed this conflict. They never intervened into the core interests of their the other superpower. They putted around the edges. Now we have terrorism, which can reach our homeland if the terrorists get weapons of mass destruction. Of course, this could be catastrophic. An example of this is that the Carter and Reagan administrations helped out the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Now, this was Afghanistan was a backwater even in the Cold War. So one wonders, they thought it was a great idea at the time to challenge the Soviets, but inadvertently, the unintended consequences of this policy was to inadvertently create one of the few threats to the homeland that we've had in the history of our republic. We haven't had that many threats to the homeland, but we have one now. So this
best defense is a good offense probably works for nation states. The football analogy, you keep the team at the other end of the field so they're not scoring at your end of the field. But the problem with terrorists is they don't stay on the field. They run down the sideline and sneak back into your goal line. So I think we need to address the root cause of terrorism. Now, the other thing that conservatives should, a couple other things that conservatives should look out for is, what do we get for the costly empire? Basically, the empires of old would go in and extract resources like the Spanish did, grabbed all the gold from Latin America. They made their colonies buy their goods. That is, they were a captive market. They taxed the colonies heavily for projects that the central government wanted to do. But we don't get any of that because it's non-PC now to do that. All we get is all the defense expenditures at $400 billion a year, and we don't even get our allies to open their markets. Every American, the average spending on defense is $1,400 per year per American on the Defense Department and the Energy Department nuclear weapons programs. So this is costly, and I'm not sure what we get as taxpayers for this. In fact, we get more terrorism, in my view. So the government is standing by its empire, defending other countries, and actually it's reducing the security at home. And the primary duty of any government first, before it does anything else, is to protect the citizens and the territory of the homeland. So, and of course, our government has not done that. One last point for the conservatives. Many conservatives are very skeptical about social engineering here at home, where the government does have some legitimacy, but they're much less skeptical that we can go and restructure other societies using the military and other governments. So, in other words, the conservatives tend to be for small government here at home, but believe in the government intervention overseas. So it's a bit of a contradiction. Now, starting on the liberals, after 9/11, we saw a $48 billion increase in the defense budget. Only $20 billion was for the actual war on terrorists. The other $28 billion was for defense pork. People were taking advantage of this to get their favorite weapon systems through Congress. Now, why should we all be against empire? War undermines our constitutional system, makes the executive branch stronger, and we already have an imperial presidency. Congress no longer declares war. We no longer have very good debates about whether to go to war in Congress. And the second reason, and I've already discussed this, so I won't go into it, is terrorism with weapons of mass destruction, which could come home to roost. And if anybody really doubts that it's our foreign policy that causes the terrorism, you really need to ask the terrorist. Bin Laden was very clear. He's never mentioned our culture or our economic or political system, and neither do polls of Islamic and Arab countries. A recent poll by Pew just reconfirmed this, but this is only one of many polls. They like our culture, they like our political and economic freedoms, but every poll they take, they say they don't like our policy, in the Middle East, particularly in the Middle East. So I think the government its main function is to provide national security, not to run an empire, and I think the two are diametrically opposed. I think by invading Iraq, Bush has played right into bin Laden's hands. Terrorists often attack the stronger party, hope they'll overreact, and then so that the terrorists can increase their recruits and funding. And that's exactly what Bush did by going into Iraq, which was unrelated to 9/11. So my policy, in short, is that we should revert to the policy of the founders, use a little bit of restraint, or use a lot of restraint in our military interventions overseas, and we should dismantle the empire. And I think we'll be a world power a lot longer if we do that. We won't overextend ourselves. We won't be so inclined to have terrorism on our home soil or anywhere else. And also, probably the most important thing is that we won't throw away all of our liberties. So I think we should be very careful when we intervene militarily, because it creates all these unintended consequences, and we've seen that in Afghanistan over the years. Thank you.
The Thank you, Ivan.